said 1, 2, 3, are you ready for this?
1, 2, 3, are you ready for this?
People, get ready.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Gather round your radio now for Juicy and Aaron.
Off air. Uncut.
Juicy and Aaron, welcome to the podcast where we get to have a longer chat with a fascinating individual.
Yes, and today we're going to enter the world of cults because we have a woman joining us who grew up in a cult and she's got out of that cult, and we need to find out what it was like and what it's like now.
So we are welcome to you, Laura McConnell. Lovely to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Laura, I said you grew up in a cult. Do you agree that you grew up in a cult? Is that the word for it?
Yeah, 100%. Some people call them sects, cults, whatever makes people more comfortable to talk about it. I don't mind. Cult is fine.
Were you born into that?
Yeah, 5 generations deep. And I think that's the thing. Lots of people don't realise we don't choose these things. We're born into them.
Mm. Yep, so 5 generations, so that, well, obviously that's like over 100 years of this cult. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty close.
So what does that mean to grow up in a cult? I mean, is it how insular is it? Are you not allowed to sort of interact with the outside world? What's it like?
Well, there's a lot of fear. So a lot of us from different cult-like organisations grow up in a mainstream community but kept very separate. So we're not necessarily in compounds, although there's some who are. Most of us live in our own family homes, but within communities where all of our work is kept within the community. We may go to mainstream schools, but we're not encouraged to fraternise, to have hobbies, to do things like sport and dancing and music and things. So we live a very parallel life, often within communities where we're just sort of left to do our own thing.
It's interesting you say that because I think back to school, and obviously as an adult when you go into an environment, if someone's by themselves, you try and bring them in. But at school when you're kids, there were often kids that were loners, and whether that's because, you know, they weren't that into being social. But look, when you say that, I think I wonder if some of those children that we thought were loners, or, you know, when you're young you're probably a bit meaner than that, were actually kids from cults who weren't allowed to actually join in or partake.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Aaron. I think it's one of the things that, especially when I speak out, I'm really passionate about, is raising awareness that they are in your schools, they're in your supermarkets, they're in your communities, especially children. It's like when you go to leave, you don't know anybody, you don't have any reference points in the world. And it is really actually important that people do recognise that we are in schools and they learn how to speak to us, they learn how to engage us, so that if we do want to leave, that we do understand how to engage with people on the outside. Because often we don't. Like, school is often the only place where we've come into contact with people on the outside. Yeah.
So what was your cult? It was religious?
Yeah, it was. A lot of them aren't, but mine was. Yes.
Yeah, so what's the religion?
Yeah, so the one I'm from is called The Truth, although they're a bit elusive. They claim not to have a name, which is also another problem and very cultish. Mm. They claim not to exist when pushed. So essentially mine is religious. Basically they believe they're the only one true way, that they have exclusive kind of access to God, and that everyone else is a false idol and all other beliefs are false, and that to leave would mean you would go to hell. And in fact, I sort of maybe mistakenly, but did believe that if we left, we would die in the wilderness.
And
is
they
Jesus
tell you
involved
that?
In
yeah.
this one? Is it, it's a Jesus
yeah,
one?
Yeah, so it's a very fundamentalist Christian belief structure. So they believe a very literal interpretation of the King James Bible, which is a very specific.
Yes, it's very specific. Yes. I have a little bit of knowledge of it, but I know that if you're hardcore James, there is no wriggle room.
Yeah, and you just believe a literal interpretation of it. So what is written there is what you believe. And, yeah, it's I mean, most mainstream Christians don't believe the Bible in that sense, which is why it leads towards the cult side, right? Because, like, we all, have different interpretations.
You, as a child growing up, and this is all you knew, obviously, but was there love around you? Did your parents, you know, hold you and tell you they loved you? And did you have an environment that was in some ways nurturing with a bit of normality and things that kids need? Because the thought of not makes me feel sick. It's awful.
Aaron, that's really sweet. Do you know, I did. I grew up in a very, very large, and that's the hardest part for me, is that I grew up in a very large, very loving, very close family community.
How many people in the community?
Look, it varies in terms of, because mine pretends it doesn't exist, it's very hard to get numbers, but there are around 10,000 here in Australia, and that has significantly diminished in the last couple of decades. There was probably closer to 50,000. Wow.
Would you go to
up.
Church like on a Sunday or yes. what? So you would go to a specific church every, like once a week or?
So the group I'm from actually shuns churches and formal buildings. They claim that they are not, that they are of the devil, and that actually we don't need earthly buildings in order to get into heaven. And so all worship in our own living rooms, and large family groups will come together and worship there, which is very helpful for them in trying to claim they do not exist because they do not have buildings.
Yeah, yeah.
Got no ideas.
Although, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses and Brethren and the like do have buildings, and they have, you know, lots of similar beliefs to the one I grew up in.
Was there one person in charge, say, in Australia, or was there some sort of godlike figure that you had to, like, you know, bow down to?
There's a very insidious, and this is often common, a very insidious leadership structure in these high-control fundamentalist Christian groups, that often you don't actually know who is in charge. There's a very, like, layered hierarchical structure. And certainly as a child I had an inkling of various people being powerful and having control, but I didn't necessarily know what their titles were, and I didn't necessarily know what power they held. Mm. I just knew that they could dictate what I was allowed to wear, that they could shame me and shun me if I acted in a certain way, or if I dressed in a certain way, or if I expressed certain opinions. So, yes, there is a structure and there is a hierarchy, but often I think, especially if you're just a lay member at the bottom of the power structure, you don't know what that structure is.
Mm. Is there a financial component where every family has to give money somewhere? Or
I think this is what it comes down to, right? Most of these cultish, sectish groups come down to two things, sex and power and money.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, we are encouraged to give. We are encouraged to give. My particular group encourages to give behind closed doors so that you never know how much somebody else has given. You don't know how much money there is. And because we don't have our own church buildings necessarily, we also don't necessarily have or have never had a corporate structure.
That's so how do you give? In cash, transfer?
Well, in cash in a little envelope.
And you don't know where the money goes?
No, you do not.
Well, no, it's going to the Lord, mate.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we're told really silly things, right? Like, you know, the workers need it, or the workers, which are our preachers, need it for their petrol for their cars to drive between the house churches. And I look back now and I'm like, what kind of fucking petrol were they using?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, these days, but back in those days, it was like 15 cents a litre.
Correct.
So when did you realise this wasn't for you? How old were you, do you reckon?
Oh, Hughesy, I reckon I always knew.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I just never fitted in. I mean, look at me. I was always creative. I was always
curious. Well, you do have a pentagram tattooed to your forehead, we should say.
Like I was just born with it on my head, you know.
As a marking, marking of the beast.
A marking of the world. I just never fitted in. It never worked for me from very, very early on. And it was very hard for me as a child because I didn't fit. Mm. But as an adult, I'm like, thank God. Mm. I just was curious. I was interested in the world. I was interested in people outside my family and community.
Mm.
I also didn't fit. Like, I didn't feel comfortable with the really strict gender and sexuality roles. I always felt like, what do you mean I have to marry one of these boys? And it felt like it worked for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I didn't think I had choices, though. That was kind of the twist to it. I didn't think I could leave because I thought if you left, you died.
Yeah.
So how did you leave then?
I made a series of decisions which I didn't realise they were all sort of adding up to me not fitting. But I really made a decision that I would finish school, and a lot of my other kind of family members and community around me, especially girls, were discouraged from doing that. And then I got to the end of year 12 and thought, well, I really would like to go and learn some more. I'd like to go get an education.
Go to university.
Go to university, yes. And I mean, I didn't really know what university meant. I didn't know how you did that. But, I literally heard that there was this thing called HEX. And I thought, they'll pay for you to go to university, which are not really how it works.
Mm.
But anyway, so I thought I'd do that. And that took me outside my family group and community in far western New South Wales. And I slowly started to meet, not in depth, but I started to meet a few people outside the group and started thinking, they're not so terrible.
Mm.
And very gradually it built up this idea in me that, there are good people outside my family and my community. And then just sort of started also my group behaving like they didn't trust me because I was not dressing the way that they wanted me to, that I wasn't staying in a relationship with a boy that they would want me to, that I was kind of expressing ideas about the world that they didn't feel comfortable with, and they very sort of slowly pushed me out from there and stopped wanting me there, and I felt I was basically shunned at the end of the day. I was shunned for my life decisions.
So was it about the age of 19, is it?
Yeah, pretty much around 19.
And so from that age, was there little contact with your family or?
I tried very hard for a lot of years to stay in contact with my family, but it was very difficult. And I'm from a very large family, and there were different layers to my family, and I tried very hard, but it was very, I mean, they would cross the street to avoid me. You know?
Including your parents? Or
no, mainly cousins and second cousins.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So my close family, I did try for a lot of years to stay very close to, but that was also very hard. You know, there's a lot of trauma and a lot of damage done inside that group. There was a lot of abuses, of which, you know, these things are just everywhere in these groups. Yeah. And that's been very hard as well.
Yeah, right. So do you have a relationship now with your family or where you're at?
It's quite distant.
Do they get angry when you talk about such things, to this sort of stuff? Or
yeah, not? It's shameful for them. I didn't for a lot of years speak until my grandparents and that generation passed away.
Yeah.
I felt like it was unfair to them because they were too old to rebuild.
Yeah.
They were too old to do anything else. So I didn't speak for a lot of years because I wanted to protect them. But, you know, I think my parents' generation and my siblings' generation, they've got options.
Yeah.
So as hard as it is for them to hear me speak, I think it's important that I do.
How many brothers and sisters do you have?
I have two sisters.
Yeah, right. Are they both still in the...
No.
No, so they've left as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. After I was one of the first in my close group to leave.
Yeah.
And that was a big responsibility and it was very hard because I felt that I was also influencing them to leave and them to make question. And that was a very uncomfortable reality for everyone in my extended family that I had influenced others
About leaving. You believe wholeheartedly that people are better off outside of this kind of cult?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, run to the hills. Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit less kind of run to the hills than I used to be. You know, I used to be like, just get out and get out now. But, you know, it's actually not that easy. Like, people leave with no support structure, no money, no home, no idea about how to work outside our communities and our families. So, you know, I say that flippantly, run to the hills, but it really isn't that simple, which is why I speak, really, because people who leave with nothing.
Do you have a lot of people talk to you going, I want to leave, I don't know how to leave, I'm too scared to leave? You get contacted a lot?
Yeah, a lot, yeah. And often it takes, some people don't leave, they just sort of stay there and play the game because it's easier to do that than it is to leave. Some people take a lot of years to leave. Often older people in particular will leave when their children are old enough to maybe leave with them.
Mm.
There is a lot of family violence and a lot of financial control. It makes, you know, walking out very difficult because you lose access to potentially your children if you've got children, potential employment, depending on what the structure of your employment is in the family and in the group.
Yeah.
So, I imagine it takes courage to speak out in the way you do, actually. Do you have people try to silence you?
You have no idea about the backlash. I try to minimise it because I don't want people to be terrified to speak.
Yeah.
But it does take a toll on me mentally because I get a lot of pushback about, oh, your experiences are old, your experiences are not current, you know, these things, you've exaggerated them.
Where does that come to you?
It comes to me from people who are very entrenched in.
But do they ring you, or how does it come to you?
Oh, well, I have a bit of a profile where people can contact me online. So they're able to find me fairly easily through social media.
But if you didn't read the comments, you wouldn't see it.
Well, they email me, so it's like...
But email me, yeah, right.
Yeah. But you want to keep in contact with people because you want for people to be able to... Yeah, so the other side comes out, so...
Yeah, well, you've got to be able to also be open enough to be like, well, I can see where you're coming from there, but also I'm here if you ever need me.
But your particular cult, did you ever get to the bottom of who is it behind it, like in Australia?
Look, I do know. I've always known, but they don't take ownership. I mean, I had emails just very recently in the last few months from the person who is the head of New South Wales and the person who is the head of Australia denying that that's their role. So they will not own their role. They will not be open about who they are and what their role in the organisation is. And that's common in these groups.
Yeah.
You know?
But there's people behind the scenes getting rich off this.
Correct. Or doing very little and being paid.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fascinating. And what you're doing is shedding light on something a lot of people have no idea about. And as you said, for those who are stuck and want to get out, you're making that a little bit easier for them, hopefully.
Well done, exactly. Let's talk about what you're doing now. Let's talk about Go Kindly, please.
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah, so when I left, I found it quite hard to sort of integrate into the world. I just knew nothing. And I basically created Go Kindly because I want the world to be a kinder, more generous place. I want workplaces to be a kinder, more generous place. And so, I created a bedding brand which operates in a kindness circle. And so we create pillows and duvets and basics bedding items. And we basically, give back the proceeds to people who are experiencing homelessness or housing stress. We try to hire from backgrounds of people that may be having trouble getting employment to give them experience. And it's really rewarding, and it sort of gives me hope about the world and makes me feel good about the world.
Yeah, good.
That is beautiful. At GoKindly, hashtag GoKindly, we will put up a link as part of this podcast so you can get involved and see the great work they're doing. Laura McConnell, thank you so much for joining us and telling us your story.
Thanks for having me.